This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Consider now the banana. Sweet and delicious, easy to peel, easy to chew, no nasty seeds to spit, always in season and always available at your local cooperative grocery store. In many ways, it's a model for the corporate food system. Humans have become dependent on fewer strains of plants delivered year-round from industrial farms. But that model also means our food is more vulnerable to disease, parasites, and pathogens. In the new book, Never Out of Season, author Rob Dunn sends a warning about the dangers of our agricultural system. Rob Dunn's a biologist and a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University and joins us again. Welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this and there's the sort of genesis of this book, Never Out of Season. What are you looking at in this book?
Well, so the book is really about, I mean, if we imagine agriculture globally, you know, depending on who's doing the math, about half of all land on Earth is now in farm. And most of those farms are of relatively few kinds of crops and relatively few varieties of those crops. And I'm at heart, a basic ecologist thinking about the general rules of life. And one of the real challenges, one of the rules we know to be deeply true, is that the more area there is of some kind of ecosystem and the more resources in that ecosystem, the more things will try to colonize it and live in it. And so we kind of have this great wave of the diversity of life sitting over the simple, simple agriculture. And it sets the stage for a real tension and sort of an existential dilemma in how we get our food. And so that really fascinated me. And so the book comes out of that question of how is it that we continue to get food moving into the future when we're using about as much land as we can get, and nature in some ways threatens us and in other ways saves us.
Well, and this has been going on for a long time. We're going to talk about industrial agriculture, which has really accelerated this process of narrowing biodiversity and severely narrowing our diet. But roughly 12,000 years ago, we settled down and began to narrow the food chain, right, or the food system.
We did. You know, if you think 13,000 years ago, all people on Earth were hunter-gatherers, and in each village, they would have been gathering different things. And then about 12,000 years ago, depending on where you were, people started to domesticate crops. And it was an amazing process that we think of as beautiful in some ways. In other ways, it was a hardship, because it was actually a lot harder to live on fewer things than it had been to live on diverse things, and hierarchies suddenly emerge. But there was that initial simplification, and then there's kind of a flowering of different varieties of each crop. But over the last 100 years, we've really seen something very different, which is that not only are we eating the same things in, you know, Raleigh versus Durham, that globally, you know, from place to place, from moment to moment, we're eating very few things. And that's a pretty new phenomenon. And I think it poses challenges we haven't thought about so much.
Well, give us the statistics, because I was shocked to read about this in your book, exactly how narrow our diet has become. 80% of our food comes from how many crops?
Yeah, so 8 to 12 crops, depending on how you do the lumping and splitting, account for most of our food. And it's amazing. I mean, it's actually so extreme that we've studied ants in Manhattan on Broadway medians, and those ants get so much of their food from the spilled over corn syrup of our diets that most of their carbon atoms come from corn. And so not only do we rely on very few crops, but so does all the life around us. It's like this great winnowing of all of life through our guts into anything near us.
And therein lies part of the danger, I mean, because that means that we are at once, things are more susceptible, are more available to us. And remember, these changes have been made in part to make them more resistant to pathogens in the outside world, but also it makes them more vulnerable.
That's right. I mean, we've sort of set up like a rumble in the jungle with agriculture, but it's not an even fight. You know, on the one hand, we have our clever scientists trying to make newer and newer varieties of crops. On the other hand, you have all of nature trying to keep up and eat those crops. And so I think the book's not a manifesto. It's a series of stories about our struggles with nature. But at the same time, one of the big points is that we need all of the tools we can get to keep up in this race. And those tools disproportionately come from nature itself. And so they come from the wild relatives of crops. They come from the heritage varieties of crops. They come from mutualist partners of crops we've never thought to study. They even come from rare wasps out in the rainforest that might someday save our crops, but that aren't yet named. And so I think that that's a really key part of the book that we see in story over after story.
So tell us the story of the banana, because I think that encapsulates a lot of what you're saying.
So the banana's amazing. I mean, so our great-grandparents wouldn't have imagined eating bananas in North Carolina. But essentially what happens is the banana moves to the Americas, and then industrial ag figures out how to make lots and lots of bananas. And the way to do it is you plant exactly the same variety of banana again and again. And because that banana grows well, it ships well, a kind of banana called the Gros Michel, you can make huge quantities of it. And so in 1940, there was a single clone of banana that stretched across much of Central America and South America, identical. You know, so it was like a giant organism, and it was perfect. But the problem was, if anything could kill one of those banana plants, it could kill them all. And so that's exactly what happens. And I think in some ways we imagine that banana story is some sort of like, it's a story of olden days. First, it's very recent. And second, really, it's actually a modern story. It's like the potato famine. It's a harbinger of the future, not of the past.
Yeah, but I'll push it a little further. We're still eating bananas today, so apparently it wasn't that big a tragedy.
Well, what happened is the banana that we were eating, the Gros Michel, was wiped out of that entire region, and the banana company scrambled and had done relatively little work to find new bananas in advance, and finally found this one, the Cavendish, which doesn't taste as good and looked a little bit different and really has different flavors. And they thought, well, I bet we can convince Americans that this is the same, and so planted that instead. And so that's now what grows. And it, too, is a monoculture, and now it, too, faces a new threat from a new pathogen. And so this isn't an exception. This is modern agriculture. We race, the things catch up, and we have to find a new way to escape.
All right. And again, as you're saying, and as you say in the book, we don't often consult nature because it's had a long track record of dealing with this in much less expensive ways, although a little bit harder to standardize, which runs afoul of capitalist production, imperatives.
I think one good news part of this story and of the book is that, you know, collectively, we're slow to consult nature. We're fastest to consult nature right after a tragedy. At that moment, we're really good at looking to nature. But there are people around the world working hard to solve these problems and to keep us ahead, you know. And so there are people doing vast amounts of work to save heritage varieties of seeds, to save the wild relatives of crops, to find the mutualists of crops. And so NC State, North Carolina State University, has actually invested a lot of money recently in a new plant sciences initiative. And part of that will look for the mutualist partners of crops that could help those crops grow. And so there are people working on it, but the default is not that we work on it. The default is we wait until something really bad happens, panic, and then search.
That brings us to chocolate terrorism. Tell us the story of cacao.
Oh, wow. Well, so I greatly enjoy chocolate, and I'll keep eating it. But chocolate depends on a web of connections, both to humans and to other species, that's pretty hard to imagine. So chocolate's native to the Amazon. It gets domesticated in the Amazon for the fruit inside the pod around the seeds, but then spreads up to Central America, and the Aztecs and Mayans used the seed to make a kind of chocolate drink. And actually, next week, I'll be talking about the book at Hunt Library, and you can try one of these chocolate drinks. But then Europeans get a hold of chocolate, and a big market emerges, and so chocolate gets planted. And again, like all of these stories, relatively few varieties get planted. And one of those varieties gets moved to Bahia in Brazil. And sort of fast forward, in the 1980s, Bahia in Brazil, and Brazil in general, was the biggest producer of chocolate in the world, but of all one variety. And then all of a sudden, this pathogen wipes out that chocolate. And there's a scramble to do something new, but quickly Brazil goes from being the number one producer of chocolate to an importer of chocolate. And the more of the story is told in the book, but what has happened in this moment is that an individual acting with his friends has intentionally introduced the pathogen of one of the pathogens of this chocolate tree, and in doing so wiped out an entire country's chocolate industry. And so to me, this is another one of these amazing moments that couldn't possibly happen. But that's 1989. Right.
Right. And again, it's monoculture that makes it so vulnerable, so that this becomes, if you are in the United States and Soviet Union remained active in the sort of the bioterrorism world and trying to figure out ways to wipe out a potential enemy's crops. So it's not like we don't think about this thing at the national level.
No, no. Clearly, I mean, the U.S. had a very large agricultural terrorism program. There are probably people listening who worked on it.
Well, and we're not alone in that. I mean, that's the point. I mean, it would be foolish to think that the world isn't figuring out ways. If they were in, facing mortal doom, you would figure out a way to menace the other country's crops. And if you've got monoculture, so much the easier to do.
Yeah, I mean, take rubber would be another great example. Right now, I mean, if you go kick the tires in your car, the side of your tire is natural rubber. It comes out of a tree from cuts in the tree. And almost all of that rubber right now is grown in Asia. And there is a blight that if introduced, one spore was introduced to Asia, would wipe out all of Asian production of rubber and stop our cars.
That's actually kind of a promising prospect to me, but that's a different story for another time. Your book tells the story about, so we talk about seed banks and heritage seeds. There are little repositories of seeds that aren't quite as, that have much more diversity, and we call these heritage seeds. But tell us a story about how Iraq had a seed bank that they had fought to protect during the 2003 U.S. invasion.
Yeah, so, you know, Iraq and Syria are such a prominent part of our modern agriculture. We talk a lot right now about refugees, and the truth is, in our daily lives, most of our food comes from the daily lives of Mesopotamians, and so Iraqis and Syrians. Our bread, our wine, our beer, our tables, our doors, so much about that daily culture. And it's still true that most of the heritage varieties of those crops on which we most depend, or some of them anyway, such as wheat and barley, are from those same regions. And so one of the greatest collections of heritage grains in the world was in Iraq when the war started, and was barely saved in a cardboard box that was shipped from Abu Ghraib, which we now know from prison horrors, and then made its way to Syria, the safe place where the seeds of Mesopotamia were being kept. The seeds of Syria have now largely been moved out of Syria to Turkey, and yet the seed keepers, the people who have worked on these seeds, are still in Syria. They're in the middle of the war saving these seeds. And so in that is the horror of all of this, but also the hope of people willing to dedicate their lives to keeping us eating.
Well, I'm going to talk more about that, the hope, and some of the projects that you're involved in that may be a way forward. But what's the worst case scenario if we don't do something about this? How do you see it playing out?
I think that the worst case scenarios right now revolve around individual crops and what happens in particular regions that are dependent on those crops. And so, for example, West Africa and then Africa in general almost lost cassava production not very many years ago. And it's those sorts of places where food is directly tied to daily life and relatively few foods that we still risk something like a potato famine. And I think that an important reality, though, of that is, and we see that in the Middle East, right? We see climate change in the Middle East. We see threats to agriculture in the Middle East. We see ongoing war. And that seems far away in some ways, but I think that the refugee crisis should make it very clear that what happens to agriculture in some place like the Middle East affects every single one of us. And so I think that that's where we first see these worst case sorts of scenarios.
Well, I know you're working on a number of projects. Your lab now is actively studying pumpkins. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Lori Shapiro, who works with us, is an amazing young scientist, and she's been working for a while on the pests and pathogens of pumpkins. And Lori's shown that there's a bacterial pathogen of pumpkins and other squash that causes bacterial wilt, which is a kind of terrible thing where squash and pumpkins get like a heart attack. Their veins clog and they wilt. And she's now shown that this is a new pathogen that beetles carry from plant to plant, but no one knows exactly where it lives or even where the beetles that carry it live. And so what we're doing is engaging anybody who's growing squash and pumpkin to help us document where these beetles live by taking pictures of them. So you can go to robdunlab.com and look for the Great Pumpkin Project and help us take pictures of those pests. But the other neat thing about squash is not only is it assailed by pests, it also depends on mutualists. And so those include among the most amazing bees I've ever seen, these squash bees. And the male squash bees, they sort of, during the day, the squash flowers close up and they hang out on the inside and sip fermented nectar and get a little drunk. And the female squash bees, in the morning and the evening, they pollinate the squash. And if you actually go out to a squash plant, you can squeeze the flowers and find the chubby males waiting there.
There's an Adam Sandler movie in this, but keep going.
Yeah, you know, I've seen it. Oh, you lost me there for a second.
Well, you were looking at mutualists, yeah. Mutualist, and they're hanging out in the bees, and the guys are getting drunk, and the ladies show up, and the bees.
And so you can help us find where those bees are, too. Are they disappearing some places? Are they places we don't think they are? How do we best make sure they stick around? And we now know from great work that those bees followed squash and Native Americans north in the Americas early in the squash story. They're part of what keeps our food going.
Well, and the other thing that you do, and you do this in the book and in all of your research, is show us about this web. I mean, you talk about a beetle that carries what we would call a pathogen because of its impact on something we like called a squash. That pathogen has its own life cycle, and it's around for a reason, and it does something. And so seeing the interconnectedness of all of this, it seems to me, is a better way forward than our kind of arms race approach in industrial agriculture that tries to wipe each thing out in series and then finds itself with the next great weapon that it's created in its own labs.
I think any chance we have to build upon and work with nature rather than fight nature is a good bet.
But I wonder, too, if there isn't some kind of a business model that works at cross purposes. You talked about your labs and investigators in public universities like ours that take a look at the interests of all of us in preserving a food supply. Industry would say that's our interest, too, but they tend toward monopoly. They would like to own the seed, own a patent on the seed, and so that 90% of all the soybeans come from one particular company. So while they would – so it seems to me they have a business model that would prefer monoculture because it sounds a lot like monopoly, which gives them control and doesn't work. Are we working at cross purposes, business and public?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of our greatest challenges on the business side is that, you know, fewer and fewer people control the seeds of civilization, literally, and some of those people are really good people, thoughtful scientists doing great work. But what we've done is that the fewer people are in charge of the seeds, the more everything depends upon their ability to be clever and thoughtful, and good-willed. And I think we'd probably be hard-pressed to imagine that we want to keep up with the pests and pathogens and save our food just by assuming that those individuals will be clever on behalf of all of us.
Well, and that nature's just going to take it laying down and not respond. So, hey, listen, I know you've got a couple of other projects, too. You've got a reading at the Hunt Library that you talked about, and there's some free tickets still available. And one project you're working on we want to let people know about is the Sourdough Bread Project.
That's right. It's actually a project in the same vein of the rest of this, which is that we depend not just on a diversity of crops, but also a diversity of microbes. And so when you make sourdough bread, instead of just using the single yeast you would buy from the store, you're using yeast and bacteria that colonize the starter from nature. And so we're taking sourdough samples from around the world to study what lives in them and which diversity, which composition of microbes makes the most flavorful sourdough, makes the most nutritious sourdough. Makes you eat that sourdough that makes you just want to sit back and have your fermented beer and not go back to work for the day.
The Odyssey of the Wild Yeast Spore. Will that be your next book?
That sounds pretty good.
Rob, what a pleasure. We got about 30 seconds. Tell us more what's going to happen on the 16th when you do your reading. You're more fun there, right?
On the 16th, I'll talk about food. We will eat some food. We will drink some beer made from the yeast that we found in wasps. And we will talk a little bit about a bunch of new yeasts we found that we need help in naming.
Rob Dunn is a biologist and a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State. His new book, Never Out of Season, he's hosting a free event to launch the book March 16th, James B. Hunt Jr. Library. It's a senior library, but he's James B. Hunt Jr. And it's in Raleigh, and you can find out more at our website. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Frank.
Just ahead, the music of Bombadil. Stay tuned.